You are listening to a sermon by Garrett Brandt, recorded on Sunday, May 1st, 2022 at Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speakers are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
It is good to be with you. Damned if you do and damned if you don't. Two tales of sexual intrigue. What do they really mean? This was the title I first gave to Andre for our little mini-series of two Sundays that we're going to be embarking on. By the way, Andre and whatever team he was consulting chose the topic, not me. So I won't take blame. But the reason I put it on my repertoire is because about 15 years ago, I did a lot of work with the Joseph Story in light of men's spirituality. But our context is very different today. And so I read with new eyes and used about one paragraph out of four pages in my previous work with this. So sometimes you got to redo things. So a little bit about the series before we get into our part one for today. I stole the first part of the title. I'm using Damned If You Do and Damned If You Don't from an essay on chapter 38. No specific explanation was given for the title, but I think I know what was intended, and I thought it fit for chapter 39 just as well. From our modern perspective, the unsung heroes of both stories were put into a moral dilemma where both options might result in damnation of some sort for them. The problem, as the author of the essay, I think, understood, is that modern moral dilemmas should not necessarily dictate how we read the scriptures. If my first part of the title didn't get your attention, the word sexual and the subtitle perhaps did. We live in a sex-saturated culture where popular media and musical and visual are obsessed with the subject. And I'd like to say that our Mennonite denominations, along with perhaps every other North American church, have become similarly obsessed. And I would say that this obsession is true for the entire spectrum of opinions on the matter. Sexuality and beliefs about it have become the ultimate litmus test of identity, belonging, and orthodoxy. I also call the content of these two chapters two tales of sexual intrigue, but you'll have noticed that I also have the question, what do they really mean? Implying that perhaps there is more going on here than sexual intrigue. Is it possible that our obsession with sexuality might actually be hindering us from hearing what these texts had to say to the ancient readers and to us? Perhaps these stories can help us to get beyond sexuality to something deeper and more central that is also relevant to our present church and denominational dilemmas. Before I look at the first of the individual stories, it's important to see both of these stories as part of a larger narrative. All of Genesis 37 to 50 is one story of Joseph and his family. So to be hermeneutically correct, one should always consider the entire narrative as one unit. Each story in the larger story is kind of like one chapter in the Joseph novella. So I'm choosing to look at chapter 39 first because the main character, Joseph, is the main character of the entire section. Even though chapter 38 has a different protagonist, it does belong in the larger narrative, as we will discover next week. Both stories have a number of important things in common. Number one, It concerns two brothers who are out far away from home. Joseph, because of forced slavery, and Judah in chapter 38, because of voluntary and natural emigration. A second thing to note that you will see in common is that clothing is an interesting ingredient in both stories. Thirdly, of course, as mentioned, sexuality and sexual acts are part of both plots. And fourthly, both main characters are outsiders. Joseph, because he was sold into slavery in a foreign country, and Tamar, because she was a woman and a Canaanite, an outsider to God's people. This story in chapter 39 opens and closes by stating the main theme of the entire Joseph story. If you'll note in verse 3 and 21 to 23 in chapter 39, that Yahweh, the God of the Israelites, was present with Joseph. And this bookends the story, and it's the main theme of the entire section from 37 to 50. Now, God's presence doesn't mean that things always go well or turn out well in the end. In Joseph's case, things did not go well most of the time. He was sold as a slave and then finds himself in prison. But even in prison, there seems to be some sense of well-being at the end of this particular episode. And again, if you notice the end of the story in chapters 47 to 50, there is a sense of well-being for his entire family. Even though, if we know the rest of the story, they also become enslaved again. But there is one constant in all the stories, and that is God's presence is the constant. So part one, Joseph, a minority man, stands up. In our story for today, we need to recall, first of all, the first episode. This is the third. The first episode in chapter 37, where Joseph is sold to traders by his brothers, and then these traders in turn sell him as a slave to an Egyptian official. The Egyptian official is named at first, but then not named after that. The Potiphar recognizes that God was with Joseph in this special way, and that everything he did turned out well. This is in keeping with the ancient worldview, and that it's always due to the gods or God. So Potiphar became very fond of his slave and made him his personal assistant. It's not uncommon for slaves. And he put him in charge of all his personal affairs, basically turned over everything in his household to him. And all because of Joseph, everything prospered for him. It says, you know, he didn't have to worry about a thing except making sure to show up for meals. Life is good. But all this good fortune for Joseph has this sinister subplot. As it says, Joseph had grown up to be a strikingly well-built young man. And it seems that as time went on, his master's wife became infatuated with Joseph and demands that he come to bed with her. Note that she is the one with power in this situation. My daughter, who is much more versed in the history of social justice movements, said this is very common. She noted white women with black slaves is very common, that then the slave would be accused of things by the woman in power. Yet Joseph refuses her advances. How could I, when your husband trusts me with everything he owns? He's put me in charge of everything. The only thing he hasn't turned over to me is you. How could I violate his trust and sin against God? Note again that the refusal here is not about sexual morality, but about his loyalty to his master as a slave and his commitment to Yahweh, his God. Well, one day it so happened that there was no other servants in the house. His master's wife grabs Joseph by his cloak and demands again, emphatically, come have sex with me. Joseph leaves his cloak in her hands and ran out of the house. When she realized that she had been foiled again and is holding his cloak in her hands, she screams to other household servants, come quick, this Hebrew slave tried to rape me, but I yelled and screamed and he ran off, leaving his coat behind. And she keeps his coat for evidence and tells her astonished husband the same story. This Hebrew slave you hired tried to mock us or insult us or to make sport of us. Various translations there. Note again that this accusation makes it an issue of power and not sexuality. A foreign slave had usurped his subservient place. Mrs. Potiphar is angry at being rebuffed and took it out on the slave. And so, of course, when the master heard this, he's furious and throws Joseph into jail. Now, if you think of ancient times, imprisonment is a rather lenient punishment for a slave who raped a master's wife. Perhaps this is another clue in the story of how Yahweh is looking after this young man. And God's presence becomes an ever increasingly powerful ingredient in the story. God's presence is nowhere claimed by Joseph, but it's simply inserted by the narrator into the story. And it continues, even when Joseph is in jail. God was kind to him, present with him, and puts him on good terms with the head jailer. And the head jailer puts him in charge of all the other prisoners, so he's basically managing the entire prison. We have to note a little bit here about jails in the ancient world. They're not managed by civic employees the way they are today. There were probably guards, but prisoners were thrown in jail, and they often organized themselves into a hierarchy. If they killed each other, it did not matter. Who cares? It was a dog-eat-dog survival of the fittest kind of world. And as we note, Joseph did more than survive. And again, God's presence saw to it that whatever Joseph touched turns out well as it could be in an ancient prison. And if we keep going on the story, we'll note later in chapter 41, 2 years later, Joseph is still in prison. And when he's brought out, even the Pharaoh notices divine presence with him. So let's reflect on this story a little bit for our own time. It's a powerful story. Not just because Joseph, as a young slave, resists his boss's wife's sexual demands. That's kind of the obvious exterior story, and many sermons have been preached to young people moralizing about, you know, the three R's of purity: resist, respond, run, or whatever clever alliteration the preacher can muster. Anyone can set up rules about sex and sexuality that can be kept or broken. But what do you do when you're in a new situation where the old rules don't apply? Well, if you're a Pharisee, you just make up more rules. But life is ambiguous sometimes, especially in the areas of sexuality and identity. We need something more than an increasing list of do's and don'ts as our culture stumbles along in deep pain. We need to get beyond sexuality. And it seems to me that for ancient readers, there was a whole lot more going on here. Let's consider again, as I mentioned at the beginning, the primary theme of the entire story, that God's presence is with Joseph, a slave in a foreign country. Why does God's presence matter? Because Yahweh, the God of the Israelites, wants to save Joseph's starving family, and indeed all of Egypt that was undergoing hard times. This is a story of God's presence with a minority people. Joseph was a minority man from an inconsequential tribe of strugglers, sold into slavery in Egypt, one of the dominant empires of the day. In fact, Joseph's great-grandfather had left the Babylonian Empire to live as a nomad. And now Joseph finds himself enslaved to another empire in Egypt. Why is Joseph our hero? Because he was a lowly young slave in an empire known for hierarchies, precision, order, most obviously illustrated by the pyramids, which still exist. He dared to take a stand against the power of the empire. Yet because of Yahweh's presence, even the damning of Joseph is part of the plot that sees him eventually rise to a position of influence in the empire. All of this to save his people and bring shalom to all people in the story. God's presence is more powerful than empires. Now, it's difficult for us to read this story from the perspective of a minority slave who stood up to an empire, because we are a powerful people. Perhaps we need to identify ourselves with the Egyptian woman rather than Joseph the slave, as we usually do. Even in Mennonite churches and denominations, we have made our own orderly hierarchies like those that held the Egyptian society in place. We might ask ourselves, how have we been seduced by hierarchy and power? If we can place ourselves in the position of the slave, how will we take a stand against such things? And perhaps most importantly, how do we understand the alternative power of God's presence? And I'll leave you with those three questions. Since I know this church has dialogue, I'll end with some questions.